Liquidity is exploding higher as we speak. If the gentle ascent continues, does that extend the bull market beyond our typical four-year cycle? I believe we could be in an environment now where the accumulation of Bitcoin remains steady for several years. I would expect the price to be between 100 and 150,000 here over the next several months. As that 50,000 realized price goes to 80, then the range then moves from, you know, to 160,000 to 240,000. I've never been able to put a year on Bitcoin hitting a million until this year, but I don't feel like it's speculative now. Now it's within, you know, our current market reach.
Bitcoin is absolutely ripping, and in every bull market, there's always a new wave of investors, and with it, a flood of new companies, new products, and new promises. But if you've been around long enough, you've seen how this story ends for a lot of them. Some cut corners, take risks with your money, or just disappear. That's why when it comes to buying Bitcoin, the only exchange I recommend is River. They deeply care about doing things right for their clients and are built to last with security and transparency at their core. With River, you have peace of mind knowing all their Bitcoin is held in multi-sig cold storage, and it's the only Bitcoin-only exchange in the US with proof of reserves. There really is no better place to buy Bitcoin, so to open an account today, head over to river.com/WBD and earn up to $100 in Bitcoin when you buy. That's river.com/WBD. Do you wish you could access cash without selling your Bitcoin? Well, Ledin makes that possible. They're the global leader in Bitcoin-backed lending, and since 2018, they've issued over $9 billion in loans with a perfect record of protecting client assets. With Ledin, you get full custody loans with no credit checks or monthly repayments, just easy access to dollars without selling a single sat. As of July 1st, Ledin is Bitcoin-only, meaning they exclusively offer Bitcoin-backed loans with all collateral held by Ledin directly or their funding partners. Your Bitcoin is never lent out to generate interest. I recently took out a loan with Ledin, and the whole process couldn't have been easier. The application took me less than 15 minutes, and in just a few hours, I had the dollars in my bank account. It was super smooth. So if you need cash, but you don't want to sell Bitcoin, head over to learn.ledin.io/WBD, and you'll get 0.25% off your first loan. That's learn.ledin.io/WBD. Mr. Nick Bhatia, how you doing, man?
I'm doing great, Danny. Good to be with you again.
Good to be with you. We've not bumped into each other in a little while. This has been probably the longest I've not seen you for in a bit.
Yeah, you're busy out in Australia, that's why.
I know, just traveling all over the place. But things are going good, man. Bitcoin's absolutely ripping. I want to talk about macro with you, but we've got to start on Bitcoin. We're at, what are we at? Just over 117K right now. That's pretty surreal on its own. But what's been your kind of take on the Bitcoin market over the last few months?
Slow and steady is my big takeaway for this bull market, and a very impressive slow and steady, because slow and steady is not really in Bitcoin's DNA, Danny, if we go back to its early history and even its recent history. So I find what I'm looking at more and more is the gentle ascent of Bitcoin's valuation relative to its underlying metrics. For example, realized value is one that I watch really closely. The gentle ascent versus a violent ascent. And if the gentle ascent continues, does that extend the bull market beyond our typical four-year cycle? I think anybody that claims they have the answer as to whether we are in another four-year halving cycle or not is ahead of their own skis. But I was joking around with, you know, our readers and community that I'm about 51 to 60% on the side that we have broken through this bull bear, this, you know, Bitcoin winter, 2 to 3 year Bitcoin winters every 4 years. I'm 51% certain that we've broken out of that. But any odds maker will tell you that even 60-40 is 50-50. I mean, 60-40 is how an odds maker just tries to get the action when they don't know when they're really 50-50. So I say it as a joke, meaning I'm somewhere between 50-50 and 60-40 that we've broken out of that. But that is my that's where I have a lot of my focus, trying to analyze that and trying to explain to the readers whether they should be thinking in terms of caution in 6 months, or is it okay to get to have a aggressive strategy for the next 6 months as opposed to a cautious strategy for the next 6 months? And that's where a lot of my analysis is living right now.
Yeah, I like that framing, because I would be the same. And I think probably some of that comes down to a little bit of PTSD. So like last bull market, the super cycle narrative was pretty pervasive. And I've been really reluctant to say, has the cycle broken? Are we in a super cycle? Or is it even just like an elongated cycle? And that's probably the one that I think is most likely, that this is, may just end up getting dragged out for another 6 months, a year, for a few different reasons. One being, I think going into the midterms next year, Trump's going to want to run these things really hot, and that's going to be good for Bitcoin if that happens. But at the same time, like I'm not willing to put my head on the line and say, no, the cycle's broken. So what would be the thing that breaks the cycle? Is this time like structurally very different?
I think that let's start with the word cycle, because if we start with the word cycle, then we're assuming that, or let's actually start with the word super cycle, because I don't even want to use that word.
No.
What I'm thinking about in terms of what, you know, the 60-40, what I'm thinking is that I believe we could be in an environment now where the accumulation of Bitcoin remains steady for several years, and the Bitcoin price oscillates around a multiple to realized value. As realized value continues to increase, Bitcoin continues to chop around 2 to 3 times its realized value, and just is in a structural bull market that can have periodic consolidations or even bear markets where Bitcoin falls 20, 30, 40%. But it's in this oscillation around 2x its realized price. So right now, the realized just crossed over $50,000 and the cap at $1 trillion. So 2 times that is 100,000. 3 times that is 150. So I would expect the price to be between 100 and 150,000 here over the next several months. As that 50,000 realized price goes to 80, then the range then moves from, you know, to 160,000 to 240,000. And that we're oscillating. Now, if you go from 240 to 160,000, that's a pullback of 33%. That could happen even over a year. And it still wouldn't be this previous, what I would call the cycle, the mining driven, the halving driven cycle, where you get these rises up to 4 times realized price and then a crash back down to 1 or even 0.9. So that is the way that I'm thinking about the next few years. And would that be a super cycle? I wouldn't really describe it as that. It wouldn't be the word to describe it, because super cycle might mean that you just continue on into elevated valuation metrics. So not that, but, and then you use elongated cycle. Perhaps that could be a better way to describe what I'm thinking about, is more of this, but I wouldn't even use elongated. I would just say that actually you break out of a cycle, and then you're more subject to global macro factors. When rates get hot, it's going to be punitive, etc., that type of thing. And then more on the adoption story. So the reason why, let's go back to the reason why we get a market price to realized price ratio of 4x. The reason why you would get 4x, for example, Bitcoin at 70,000 in 2021 when realized price was at around 15,000, 17,000. You get that type of gap when you don't have structural selling in the market. You have so much exchange-based, futures-based leverage trading, and you get this extreme profitability in the market that is not really tapped because you don't have structural selling, you don't have selling calls on ETFs, you don't have all of these vehicles that are managing the volatility down. And so one of the charts we've been charting is Bitcoin's trailing 30-day volatility historically. And if you it's just compressed. And the last 3 years, the volatility can be described as muted versus trailing 5 to 10 years. Even if you look at 2021, the volatility was so much more than it is today. And so this compressed volatility is the new structure of the market, I believe.
Uh-huh.
And compressed volatility prevents the 4x MVRV ratio. And if you can never get to 4x, then you can avoid the winter. Because the winter is so much destruction on the technical chart. And so you avoid the destruction. And I believe that the structural buyers, for example, the strategies of the world, they would love to prevent overheated Bitcoin prices because they believe that it could lead to a more winter-like environment in the subsequent months or years. So that's, I hope, Danny, I've answered a few of your questions in terms of how I'm thinking about this current bull market.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And so like what you're saying there is we won't get the blow off top like we have in previous cycles, but at the same time, it mutes downside volatility.
I'm in that 60-40 that we would avoid it. Yes, I'm hoping that.
Yeah. And like I like that idea for a couple of reasons. One, just I would prefer that. But I also think it makes it way more sustainable for people to build Bitcoin businesses. Because like when we have the, 2 years of just down only, obviously, like the first companies to go in the last cycle are all the fraudulent ones. But then there are real good Bitcoin businesses that just can't survive 2 years of negative price action. So I think that's a way more sustainable path if we can manage to do that. Is this just part of the market maturing?
I do think that it is part of the market maturing. And I use the word market structure a lot because it is about structure. Options, hedging, calendar. Calendar is so important for risk management. If you can sell options 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, and 12 months forward, you can buy options 3 months and 6 months forward. You can plan, you can manage risk, and all of that mutes the volatility so that when you get, let's say we got a rise from today at 117 to 138, which is around my, medium-term target. I'm not the only one that's looking at a 61.8% Fibonacci extension from previous breakouts. Everyone has their stop orders and their call options and their structure around the risk. And they understand that as this market matures, it's not going to go from 138 to 170 in the blink of an eye. They're not going to miss out. So they need to sell, lock in, create the income for themselves based on this basically herd mentality that we're not going to get the blow off top. So I see the call option volume on at higher strikes, and it's not just Bitcoin, it's IBIT, it's MSTR, it's there's so many vehicles. And so all of that, you're talking about maturity. It's the maturity of the structure, the vehicles, the options, the calendar. That's what suppresses the volatility, because remember, volatility is a function of options pricing. Not realized volatility. Realized volatility is statistical look back, which in Bitcoin is declining, right? The realized variance looking backwards is declining. However, volatility is priced based on implied volatility is based off of options prices. And so if you are buying options, you are increasing volatility. But you, if you're an option seller, you knock that price of volatility back down. So it's the volatility sellers that have graduated from basically not even having the vehicles to now having the full suite of vehicles, selling options on IBIT, Bitcoin futures, MSTR, across multiple vehicles, across the entire calendar. The structural sellers physically mute implied volatility and dampen forward price action. That's how the stock market works, Danny. And so when we look at SPY options across the curve and across the calendar, that's how we manage risk in equities, is that we know that there are levels at which volatility will, I'm sorry, the price will stop rising or stop falling, because there's just a lot of buyers and sellers around those areas. Bitcoin players will always get rinsed in the absence of good risk management. And so it is alarming, Danny, the number of companies that are popping up. You have to think then, they're all competing over capital. So which ones are able to raise the most equity? And of the equity holders, how long are those equity holders going to be willing to be patient? Not all of these companies are going to be able to issue debt or borrow in order to sustain. So the corporate finance expertise, I don't know if you just caught the news that Strategy released yet another vehicle, which is now targeting the shortest duration of fixed income money market funds and is trying to offer a dividend or a yield with a stable net asset value at around 100, or par, as we call it in money market fund land. So completely giving up capital appreciation, but also combining with a short duration. This is sophisticated layering of the liability side of the balance sheet, liability plus equity, all of that to leverage the assets, leverage up the assets and buy as much Bitcoin as possible. Not everybody is going to be able to compete with that. So yes, if you have more companies, you have more Bitcoin demand, but the Bitcoin demand from the companies comes with owing debt and equity to people. And so their patience will be tested, and they will withdraw when they don't see the results. And that can create bankruptcies and all of that. But if you look at the number of coins that has, you know, come to market, let's just say with these recent 2011 coins that have started to move on chain, come into the custody of Galaxy, which we know is a big shop. Maybe the coins are moving for taking dollars out against collateral. Maybe it's to sell. Doesn't really matter. 80,000 coins. How does it knock the market? It just doesn't. So you have Strategy at 600,000 coins, but the rest of these companies buying a few hundred coins, or I don't even mean to, you know, dismiss a 4,000 coin purchase, but that's what MicroStrategy does when it's sleeping. You know, it'll buy another 4,000 coins. So if you have a few companies go under, 4,000, 8,000, 20,000 that are, you know, spot liquidated,
it really doesn't matter.
I don't know that I don't know that it hits the market. I mean, in a material way. Now, to all the people investing in the equity and debt instruments of these individual companies, I can't give all those people a pat on the back and say best of luck to you. It's more, you know, may God be with you in your endeavors. But you know that it's not my game. As you know, as a macro analyst, you can't necessarily be an equity analyst, and so I'm not going through the capital structure of these companies and saying which ones are good, which ones are not. Management will matter, and what I can tell you, Danny, is that reading the sophistication of MSTR's capital structure, the different vehicles, and how they are layering their approach to liability management, because that's the name of the game, I can promise you that the level of sophistication is going to be in the I'm just making up a number, 10x to 20x the skill set level that some of these other companies will employ. And that's not me, you know, discrediting the corporate finance officers at these companies. It's just the size that Strategy has, the way that they're able to layer it out. It's very impressive to me as more of a corporate finance tourist myself. And I'd proudly call myself that, a corporate finance tourist. I teach corporate finance in its minutiae as it applies to fixed income, US treasuries, thinking about economics. But I'm not a, you know, corporate balance sheet analyst by trade. And so, but I can recognize those that are really good at it. And I can also understand that those that are not really good at it can maybe fake it till they make it, but that won't make, you know, every one of those last forever.
Yeah, that makes sense. Just quickly back to the cycle thing. I've spoken to like a ton of macro people on the show over the last few months. And one of the things that a lot of people tie the sort of traditional Bitcoin cycle to is not necessarily the halving cycle, although that definitely plays into it, but more a global liquidity cycle. First of all, do you think that's the case? And then secondly, do you think that could mean that we don't actually exit this kind of 4-year cycle that we're in, and instead, like, rather than staying in a super cycle or extended cycle, whatever you want to call it?
So as you know, Danny, I'm a liquidity, I've built a lot of the analysis that we're building at the Bitcoin layer around liquidity. We have our own
liquidity
index.
Maxi.
I certainly am. But I'm not a liquidity cycle maxi.
Okay.
Okay. And so I don't know that just because we had an inflation wave that was mostly supply side driven, as we saw inflation go from 2 to 9 back to 2%. That was a pandemic induced, a one-off. Not, it's one-off structurally increased inflation from the 1 to 2% to now the 2 to 4%. I genuinely believe we're in this structurally higher inflation. But that doesn't mean that because there was restrictive in 2021 and 2022 as rates were skyrocketing, that then we get easy in 24, 25, that then it's followed by restrictive in 26, 27. I don't necessarily follow that approach. I'm looking at liquidity in the way that we analyze it, which is the size of the banking system, treasury volatility, and I'm analyzing it as a in the spot market. Like, where are we? Where have we gone? Rate of change matters a lot, but I'm not thinking it in terms of 3, 4, 5, 6 year cycles and how that liquidity cycles through the system. Now, you know, my mentor, Michael Howell, has this 5-year number that every 5 years, because of the quantity of debt and the size of the economy, that every 5 years, there's a rollover risk for the debt of the system. I don't disagree with that either. But again, I'm more like, let's look at treasury volatility today. Let's look at the rate of change over the last 30, 60, 90 days. How is it going? Well, I'll tell you, it has collapsed. Volatility has collapsed in treasury land. The MOVE index has collapsed. I ran the numbers last night. 12 of 14 red weeks on the MOVE index. What have stocks done? They've gone straight up. And so that is the framework working in real time. For me to, I'm not like other analysts in that I can always think in this 2 to 3 to 5 year in advance and where the cycles are. I have to more live in the now. I was also running the numbers on treasury, 10-year treasury rates. They're at 4 1/3 today, approximately. Well, guess when we were at 4 1/3? 2 months ago, 4 months ago, 10 months ago, 18 months ago. I mean, when we tagged in October of 2022, we tagged 4 1/3 on the way up, but then you've been flat. So the rate of change was punitive in 2021 and 2022, but then it stopped being punitive. So that 4 1/3 looked like a disaster in October of 22, but today it's not a disaster. In fact, it's actually a supportive. It's not even normal. It's supportive because stocks are at the all-time high, and that's crazy. That's how we have to think about it. So where is liquidity? Liquidity is exploding higher as we speak, despite 4 1/3 on tens, because if you think about 4 1/3 on tens 3 years ago, you're thinking about it wrong. It's 4 1/3 today and collapsing volatility, as opposed to 4 1/3 3 years ago and spiking volatility. While stocks are at the all-time high today, it means that 4 1/3 is a good liquidity condition. It's providing liquidity. And that's how I have to live in my analysis, is I have to look at where we are, rate of change, how it's affecting multiple asset classes. I think for sure that Bitcoin's 2022 bear market is driven by a spiking of broad macro volatility due to the inflation wave, due to interest rates. And we talked about it. It's not that the Fed is hiking. The market sells the bonds before the Fed hikes. So it's the market punishing and liquidity being sucked out of the system, volatility spiking, markets stopping, you know, to be made, people pull back from their Bitcoin position, and then the reversal happens in the subsequent years. So that's how I'm thinking about it.
So I definitely want to get deeper into the macro stuff and what that means for Bitcoin. But before we move on from kind of the cycle stuff, do you have a sort of target in mind for this year, next 12 months, whatever it is? And no one's going to hold you to this, Nick. But I did see you tweet recently that Bitcoin's going to 1 million, but it's not going to be straightforward. I mean, we know Bitcoin's going to 1 million. It's when, not if.
Right. And that, I think that that's part of what's making this new era of Bitcoin fun, is the increasing certainty that it gets to 1 million in the 2030 to 2032 area. That's something itself that I've never been able to put a year on Bitcoin hitting 1 million until this year. So this is the first year I've been like, okay, by 2032, you might expect Bitcoin to be at $1 million. That's 7 years from now. The next order of magnitude, we hit 10,000 in 2017, so 7-8 years from 10 to 100, another 7 to 1 million, and you can really put it there and be like, yeah, you know, the next order of magnitude is 7 years away. That's amazing, and I love that. It also means that the obsession over 1 million on this current cycle, that's not where the action is or the analysis is to me. It means that at this portion of the cycle, we should be thinking about 200, 250. And so that I am starting to think that 200 to 300 is what my expectation has been for the last few years, but it's starting to lock in. I think I was doing some back of the envelope that, you know, 225, somewhere around there in the next 12 to 18 months seems very, very realistic to me. The numbers that I was using there, 70,000 on realized and 3x on the MVRV puts us at 210. And I really like thinking about 210. It's a nice multiple of 21 as well. And so we'll put it there at 210, Danny. I don't want to put a time on it, but I'm not talking about 5 years here. I really am talking about 1 to 2 years now, looking at like the next. When we remember when you guys were in my corner and we did that in person, we were talking about 300 and what would it take to get to 300K. And that was, I felt like it was much more speculative at the time. But it's, I don't feel like it's speculative now. Now it's within, you know, our current market reach.
It is wild though that the idea of throwing out $1 million Bitcoin isn't that crazy anymore. I remember saying to people that Bitcoin's going to go to $1 million in like 2017, and people looked at you like you were fucking nuts. And if I say that to people now, even if they're not very into Bitcoin, people are like, oh, okay, I can see that. And that like mind shift is crazy. It's wild to see, and it's bullish.
It is. You have to lean into it too, because it, you have to normalize it. And it's my responsibility to normalize it to the readers, because, you know, I'll single out a reader that I have, and God bless him, but he pinged me around the week of Liberation Day, and he said, I sold it all. He's an older gentleman, not an American, had set himself up very well, but, you know, he's out, and he was a longtime reader, and it wasn't enough. What we were doing wasn't enough to keep him from doing that. Not that it's our responsibility to prevent him from selling or to hold it all the way to the end. But okay, then yes, we do need to do a better job, or change the language, alter it to make it more as something that people expect.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons I do it as well. It's more to kind of shock people into taking it seriously. Like I want people who I care about to own Bitcoin. And I feel like that's a really easy way to make them take this thing seriously if they think it's going from 100K to $1 million in a relatively short amount of time. But let's get on to the macro stuff. I think to kind of set everything up that I want to talk to you about, we should probably talk about Jerome Powell and Trump. Because Trump seems to be doing everything he possibly can to push Powell out of that seat. But let's start with Powell. Do you think, if you take into account everything that he's gone through sort of after the pandemic and high inflation, do you think he's done a good job as Fed chair?
The reason I like Powell, Danny, has less to do with his policy. We'll talk about his policy too. But the reason I like Powell is we're coming off of Yellen and Bernanke. And I was on the desk for both, so I got to experience, you know, this is my third Fed chair, let's just say, in my career. I like Powell because he doesn't insult my intelligence when he talks. Doesn't mean he doesn't have a political slant. Sometimes you can hear his political slant. But he doesn't talk down to the financial participant and try to tell them the condition. He's more descriptive, and he's a financial market practitioner. So he does understand things like volatility, bid-ask spreads, and options pricing. He's not that economist guy that Bernanke and Yellen were and are. The hardcore academic economist. He's a private equity guy. He's a private sector background guy. Right, he is a long Fed career, so I don't want to just put him as, you know, as like a Bessent, for example, which, you know, spent four decades in the private sector, a Druck guy, a Soros guy, and then he comes into the Treasury Department. So I've always liked Powell more than the previous two, because when he does the presser, I don't feel offended. And I mean, it might sound silly, but whenever Yellen or Bernanke spoke, I felt personally insulted that you think this, you're taking my time. If I'm going to listen to you, I don't want to hear propaganda. I want to hear more ascription of the situation. So that's how I feel about Powell generally. The policy, yeah, he was late in 2021 by a mile. The 2022 QE, 2021 and 2022 QE will, I think, forever be inexplicable. from a pure Fed independent standpoint. But if you, and I know that you've done lots of work on this, Danny, the arrangement between the Treasury and the Fed Department during the 40s up until the 1951 Treasury-Fed Accord, when, you know, they unpegged rates from where the government was setting them. The 40s were a war period, and this was a non-war period, war-like spending program, and the government needed to do that to prevent collapsing GDP. So instead of blaming Powell, maybe we assume that he didn't really have much choice on the 2022 decisions to do extended QE. Maybe he didn't have any choice. Maybe he was tapped on the shoulder to do that because of the CARES Act and, you know, the $3 trillion that had to be rolled out to the market and the excess Treasury supply that needed to be absorbed to not shock the market. So we're on the topic of Fed independence. That's where this conversation is going. Let's think about whether even that was independent, Powell, or whether it wasn't. I don't think there's much of an argument to say that he was independent when they were doing that secondary QE infinity. That doesn't, I mean, it was terrible monetary policy, but what if he didn't do it? And that spending package was still had the green light. What would that have done to the Treasury market? So what about Powell's policy? Another thing is the SOFR wave. He was one of the architects. I believe the acronym was AARC. I was studying it when I was on the desk. The Alternative Rates Committee, that's what the ARC, I can't remember exactly what, the Alternative Rates Committee, it was like the LIBOR cert, the search for the replacement of LIBOR. This was going on during 2017. Powell was one of the architects of this. And then he came in, he pounded the table on SOFR, and it all went over my head at the time. I did not understand this. I was barely getting into LIBOR. Like, my first real LIBOR mentor was 2018 as SOFR was popping up. I'm like, what is LIBOR? Why is it so important? I was actually asking, why are all these bonds that I'm trading issued out of London and trading off of LIBOR? I don't understand it. It was the offshore dollar system, but I didn't understand what I was trading at the time. So I definitely didn't understand the foresight of trying to bring a repo rate into the US dollar capital market to anchor activity going forward. I understood repo. I understood why it was a great rate. I traded repo. So I understood why this is a brilliant rate to use. I still didn't put the pieces together. So Powell's ability to help the nation, or I shouldn't even say help the nation. Maybe he is patriotic in that way, or maybe his directive was to protect the United States of America as a nation. But from a capital markets perspective, he was trying to reduce the influence of non-US banks. Where is that in any of the conversation? See, it's not really present. So how do I feel about Powell versus Trump? Well, I don't actually know that it has anything to do with Fed independence at this point versus 2022 versus 2024.
This episode is brought to you by the massive legends Iron, the largest NASDAQ-listed Bitcoin miner using 100% renewable energy. Iron are not just powering the Bitcoin network, they're also providing cutting-edge computing resources for AI, all backed by renewable energy. We've been working with their founders, Dan and Will, for quite some time now and have been really impressed with their values, especially their commitment to local communities and sustainable computing power. So whether you're interested in mining Bitcoin or harnessing AI compute power, Iron is setting the standard. Visit iron.com to learn more, which is iren.com. What if you could lower your tax bill and stack Bitcoin at the same time? Well, by mining Bitcoin with Blockware, you can. New tax guidelines from the Big Beautiful Bill allow American miners to write off 100% of the cost of their mining hardware in a single tax year. That's right, 100% write-off. If you have 100K in capital gains or income, you can purchase 100K of miners and offset it entirely. Blockware's mining as a service enables you to start mining Bitcoin right now without lifting a finger. Blockware handles everything from securing the miners to sourcing low-cost power to configuring the mining pool. They do it all. You get to stack Bitcoin at a discount every single day while also saving big come tax season. Get started today by going to mining.blockwaresolutions.com/WBD, and for every hosted miner purchased, you get 1 week of free hosting and electricity. Of course, none of this is tax advice. Speak with Blockware to learn more at mining.blockwaresolutions.com/WBD. One of the things that keeps me up at night is the idea of a critical error with my Bitcoin cold storage. This is where AnchorWatch comes in. With AnchorWatch, your Bitcoin is insured with your own A-plus rated Lloyd's of London insurance policy, and all Bitcoin is held in their time-locked multi-sig vaults. So you have the peace of mind knowing your Bitcoin is fully insured while not giving up custody. So whether you're worried about inheritance planning, wrench attacks, natural disasters, or just your own mistakes, you're fully protected by AnchorWatch. Rates for fully insured custody start as low as 0.55% and are available for individual and commercial customers located in the US. Speak to AnchorWatch today for a quote and for more details about your security options and coverage. Visit anchorwatch.com today. That is anchorwatch.com. That's interesting to hear, because like, I've always thought it was a bit of a charade that the Fed is independent. Like, clearly it's not fully independent. But if Trump does manage to get Powell out and bring in someone who's basically going to work on behalf of the Treasury, that line gets blurred way further. Do you see that as being a problem then, or not really? It sounds like you're saying that may not even be a big issue.
It becomes a little bit political in that it's going to be more overt as opposed to the 2022 when it's less overt, that it's just the Fed responding to conditions, independent monetary policy. Oh, and it so happens that that Congress and the president are passing $2 trillion deficits also. So is it a problem? Perhaps. Bessent is on the tape today again saying that the independence of the Fed is so crucial to the health of the US economy. So they're saying all the right words in terms of the independence. He's saying, but they also are doing all these other things. There's mission creep, so we have to open up the whole thing to investigation. I think that it would be material if they overtly strip away some of the independence, but material to what? Material to the current politics. But if you go back to the 40s, it's not even remotely different than something that's happened only 8 decades ago in a period that, hey, we are also in a new period. So what happened in 1944? Bretton Woods Agreement. There was a new monetary system that was arranged in 1944. It didn't even really kick off until 1958 because of capital controls in Europe. That's something that was in my book, and I know it's something that, you know, you've talked about on your show as well, that the Bretton Woods Agreement and the system didn't even really get going until 58, and it basically died in 68. So what are we living through? So if 44 was a time that the U.S. had to redo the monetary system and protect itself, and it had a Treasury Fed Accord for many years during that time, how is this that different? And if it's the same, is that bad, or is that in the national interest? And if it is in the national interest, should we criticize a faltering of independence when you have, it's not even a speculation whether it went non-independent during the 40s until 51. That's what it was. It was not independent. The Treasury was pegging rates of the bills, and the Fed would buy them at. And actually, what you learn when you learn about the history is that the Fed didn't really even have to move the market. The Fed didn't really have to participate. It just kind of guides by its policy and then the market adheres to it. So it's quite natural, I think, for it to go back this way. Doesn't mean you won't get critics of the faltering of independence. But again, that's probably another 10 questions.
Because obviously, like, the start of this fallout between Trump and Powell is really that Trump wants to cut rates and Powell's been really reluctant to do so. Do you think there's an argument that Powell should be cutting rates?
Yes.
What is the argument?
The argument that Powell should be cutting rates is that the curve isn't necessarily steep enough. It's at about 50 basis points. I'm talking about twos, tens. It could be at 100, and that, I would argue, would be even healthier for the economy. A steeper yield curve is good for banks. They borrow short, and they lend long, and they capture the curve. And with more steepness in the yield curve, they have more protection for their profitability. And the 2-year yield has been guided a little bit lower than where the Fed funds rate is today, which means the market has room for them to cut. I don't know that rates need to be at 2% because again, it goes back to what we said about 4 1/3. And I realize that's tens and we're talking about twos, different parts of the yield curve. With tens at 4 1/3 and the stock market raging on, do we need lower rates? No, I would argue no, we don't really need lower rates because stocks are doing great with Feds with tens at 4 1/3. So why do you need twos to go from 4 1/3 to 3.5? Not necessarily.
Can I ask you a question on that just so I can understand a little bit more?
Yeah.
Are rates at that while stock market is at basically all-time highs because the market is factoring in inflation? Is the market saying they think inflation's coming back?
No, I think that we talked about this last time. When you decompose the yield of tens into the TIPS yield, which is the real yield, that's a market yield that you get plus inflation. You get this coupon plus inflation. You strip out the real yield, then what you're left over is the break even, the inflation break even, the assumption of CPI going forward. It's frozen at 2. It just doesn't really move from 2 to 2.25 and hasn't for the last 3 years. So the expectation for inflation going forward is somewhere in the 2 to 2.5%. It's not
interesting.
It's not very high. And the real yield is also around 2 to 2.25%. And which means that if you own treasuries, you have an option. I can either get 4% from the notes, or I can get 2% from the TIPS. I expect them to come out even because I could either get 4 or 2 plus 2. That's going to be the same. If it wasn't, if you had, let's say they expected 5% inflation, you know, in 3 years from now, you would be buying TIPS at 2 because you get 2 plus 5. I'm going to get 7% next year or in 2 years. That's a buy all day. But it's not. I mean, TIPS would be trading at 0% or negative, which they had. You know, TIPS had traded at a negative yield for quite often over the last few years. I should say going back 10 years, it's traded negative. It just means that the inflation expectation going forward is not much more than 2. If it was, you wouldn't be able to buy TIPS at 2 because it's free money.
That makes sense.
It's free money, right? It's a break even.
So if we get into like the more speculative side of this, then let's say Jerome Powell does get ousted, Trump brings someone in. I imagine the easy assumption there is the first thing they do is start cutting rates. Does that then lead to a higher chance of inflation going forward?
Of course. Well, when you pump the economy, when you lower rates, we'll just go first, second order, third order, right? When you lower rates, you spur borrowing. When you spur borrowing, you create new money, right? That's credit creation. When you create new money, you increase aggregate demand because there's just new borrowers, there's just more money. When you increase aggregate demand, inflation goes up. So it's 1, 2, 3, 4, and it happens boom, 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 boom. That's it. So yes.
And do you think the question is, what else do you think the next Fed chair will likely do? Do you think things like QE will come back?
I don't think you need, and I think they're trying to go away from that. I think they're trying to go away from the swelling of the Fed's balance sheet being such an influential part. I think back to the dual public good that this administration is trying to address. They have come out and said, we are providing the world a dual public good of treasuries as a reserve asset and global security. We are going to reduce the public nature of that good, meaning you have to pay for it now. So the defense is easy because you just have to purchase more weapons. If you purchase the weapons, then we will protect you. So that's easy. But how do you get them to reduce their reliance on treasuries as the reserve asset? You actually have to buy less from them on net. And so you send less dollars out. So if you send less dollars out, they have less money to buy treasuries. Well, then you better not issue so many treasuries. You better reduce the amount of treasuries that you're issuing. And so the shift into Bitcoin policies and supporting the idea of Bitcoin, even talking about gold, you know, the whole Fort Knox thing, something that's so funny because I saw an absolutely epic meme of Trump. It's the mom in the pool holding up a smiling baby. The smiling baby is Coca-Cola with real sugar. The other baby is drowning and it's the Epstein files. And then at the bottom of the pool, the skeleton is the Fort Knox audit.
I thought, yeah, we didn't get that live stream audit that they promised.
We certainly did it. But I say all this to say that increasing the legitimacy and popularity of gold and Bitcoin as neutral reserve assets reduces the necessity of foreign governments to stockpile treasuries as the reserve asset. Because, oh, the US is doing it too, you know, stockpiling these other reserve assets, this is going to be good for us. So your question was about QE. I say all of this to say the US government, from a policy perspective, actually wants less debt relative to the GDP. They want that number to go down. And if it goes down, you are less so reliant on the central bank to stockpile treasuries and all of that kind of stuff. Do I think that they need that they're trying to get their own Fed chair so that they can do their own version of the CARES Act or this, you know, big, beautiful bill cubed where they borrow and spend $10 trillion on energy grids and energy infrastructure and new nuclear power plants? I don't really think so, Danny, that that's part of what they're trying to do is like a blank check for 100 new nuclear power plants and rewiring the electricity grid around the country and, you know, rebuilding bridges and ports and all of that kind of stuff. I don't think so. I actually really don't believe that that's what they're trying to do. They want the private sector to do it. They want U.S. banks to lend. It's actually the same thing as the CBDC versus stablecoin thing. It's all about public versus private. They want digital dollars. They just don't want to issue. They don't want the central bank to issue. They don't want to issue them. They just want the banks to do it. So they want the private sector to do all this growth, build out. They want the banks to lend, and they just want to be supportive. Low regulation, low taxes. I know it's a very long answer, but I don't believe that it's a QE for the blank check for 100 nuclear power plants funded by the US Treasury.
Okay, interesting. So on the Bitcoin stuff, I got you to speculate a little bit. If you had to speculate here, do you think, again, let's say in the next 12 months, probably sooner, Powell loses his job and rates get cut?
Politically, I do believe that's where we're going. I don't know how healthy it would be to slash rates, let's just say, right? Stocks at an all-time high. Inflation isn't reined in.
It'd be good for Bitcoin.
I want to see Bitcoin weather all the storms, not just get a free ride, which is why I don't really believe that, again, 4 1/3 stocks at all-time high. You don't need stimulation. It's actually stimulative. It's unbelievable to see the economy and the stock market both do what they have with tens at 4 1/3 for 3 years. It's incredible. One must marvel at it. You think about, Danny, all the, and I'm going to pick on maybe some of the people you interview. Think about all the hysteria about treasury auctions. Oh, uh-huh. My God. Treasury auctions are failing. Every 3 months, like one 20-year goes bad. And everyone's like, treasury auctions. Are you kidding me? 3 years with rates absolutely flat. The last 5-10-year auctions have gone stop through, meaning more demand in the moment than where the going in price was. It's called when issued market. 5 straight months that tens have beat the when issued market. This is I wouldn't say you're in a raging bull market, but this is a very stable market. Not only is it stable, but volatility is collapsing, which rewards all the risk holders. Treasury market stability has been the name of the game for 3 straight years. So what does the Fed, what does Trump or Bessent need to get the Fed to do for them other than one thing? Annual interest expense, right? Which feeds directly back into how much they can cut taxes and all that kind of stuff. That's this fiscal dominance idea. Annual interest expense, the actual dollars that they spend, they're like, hey, please cut the rate so that our actual interest dollars that we spend can go down so that we can cut taxes and not get scored by the CBO in this, you know, negative way that makes all the headlines say you're increasing the deficit. They're not actually increasing the deficit. They're reducing taxes, hoping that the deficit doesn't continue to spiral. But yes, that's the way that it gets spun and that the CBO scores it, is that when you reduce taxes, well, if the interest rate doesn't come down, you're going to have a deficit and it is going to grow. That's just math. So it is about math. They want it lower because of this first order effect reason. Not to do all this. And I want to mention one more thing. I was in Washington in January and I got to go to the Capitol and chat. It was obvious to me that this false narrative of poor treasury auctions was an underlying scare tactic for the government to get the votes, to get stable coins so that you can have an additional buyer of treasuries.
It was a psyop.
It's everyone was talking about it. It was obvious to me. I actually think it's good, right? The stable coins being another source of treasury demand. It's good. It's not going to save the treasury market. It wasn't necessary to save the treasury market, but they got it. It's another buyer. The treasury market didn't need saving. It is, again, it's stable. It doesn't mean that they can ignore it. Like, they're doing everything they can to structurally reduce the amount of net imports, right? I mean, everything from tariffs to the tomato ban now on Mexico, every little marginal thing that they can to prevent the export of dollars, the stockpiling of treasuries abroad, they can. They're trying to do. And maybe it is contributing and maybe it's not. But the U.S. Treasury right now is in a decent place. And look at the June numbers. I literally fell out of my chair when I saw that they had a surplus in June. I mean, is that a weak treasury market or a good treasury market where you're actually turning a surplus? Even if it's 1 month, it's a little surprising to the upside.
To try and take this back to like the start of the conversation when we're talking about Bitcoin cycles, is there a bit of a strange irony here where someone coming in to replace Powell, cutting rates, might lead to Bitcoin pumping and be one of the things that mean we stay in the four-year type cycle if we have more of a blow-off top type event and things do have to pull back down?
I can't really see that happening. Okay. I don't think that a new Fed chair pumps Bitcoin.
There's the quote.
I don't think that one person, even Donald Trump, can have that type of effect. Remember that the current wave of pro-Bitcoin policy is driven by the electorate. Trump mm-hmm. is responding to the electorate. It's not a Trump. Trump is not the one that's like, let's use Bitcoin to save the nation.
He tells us that it's him pumping Bitcoin.
Yeah. He loves himself.
Yes, that's clear. Well, Nick, you're the best. I've really enjoyed talking to you. Always do. Where do you want to send anyone to find out more about Bitcoin Layer, the Bitcoin Age, all the work you do?
TheBitcoinLayer.com is where people can find all of the work. So it links to the channel. It links to our research offering and my two books, Layered Money and Bitcoin Age. So TheBitcoinLayer.com, you guys can find everything that we're doing over there.
Amazing. Thank you so much for this, Nick. It was good. And we'll definitely catch up in October as well when I'm in LA.
Danny, all the best. Thank you so much. Appreciate you.
Thank you, man.